Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guess.
Hello, hello, and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. We are at episode number 139. I'm Paul Spain, and with me for this episode, we have
Earl Tippany from Adobe.
And Nate Dunn.
Welcome along, guys. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Paul.
Earl, your very first time on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. You'd better share with us where you fit into the technology world.
Okay, so I'm a solution consultant based in Auckland, and my role is really around supporting our products and making sure people are aware of what we're doing and what's in the market and what our new tools are. So I've been with Adobe now for probably about a year and a half, through some pretty exciting times with the release of the CS6 and now Creative Cloud. But previous to that, sort of been in the reseller space for Adobe and also, as a user of their products for probably 25 years.
25 years? That's impressive. That's impressive.
It's a long time.
And Nate, remind us where you fit into the tech community.
I own a software company called 3Bit, and we develop with Xero, which, as we were just discussing before, is New Zealand's favourite publicly listed company, and also own a cafe as well, so that keeps me busy, and blog on GeekZone, and moderator on GeekZone, and I'm Nate on Twitter, which I was in the States about 3 weeks ago talking at a tech conference, and I flashed up that my Twitter handle was Nate, and pretty much the conversation after the presentation had nothing to do with the content. It was just, how did you end up being Nate on Twitter? I was like, well, thanks, guys. I'm glad that I'm well prepared for this presentation. Let's just talk about my Twitter handle.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Excellent.
My claim to fame.
And I am the host of the NZ Tech Podcast, as well as being the CTO at Gorilla Technology, which is an IT services firm here in Auckland. Well, let's jump into our topics. Now, first up, there was quite a cool little thing that created a buzz last week. Was a graduate of Victoria University has come up with a concept for a 3D printed plaster cast for helping you heal your broken bones. Although it's not actually a plaster cast, it's a really funky 3D printed replacement. What did you guys think of this?
Very cool. As someone who's broken bones before, the most annoying thing I think about a cast is how itchy it gets. And I think that's the first thing I spotted with this, is with all the sort of lattice design in the space, is the fact that you can scratch away to your heart's content. And I'm assuming, too, the other second annoying thing with having a cast is trying to shower. It's really annoying doing it with a plastic bag or the rubbish bag over the hand.
Yeah, and this is supposed to solve both of those issues, right?
Yeah, so this could save the world.
Well, as a parent of a son walking around with a cast at the moment, who's just jumped into his moon boot, and he's pretty happy about that, he'd love this.
Yeah,
awesome.
It looks like a really cool design, and quite cool how this has been picked up by a lot of particularly tech type media and so on, all around the world. The article I sort of shared with you guys was the one that that Wired ran on the story. Now, can somebody help me out? How do I pronounce the chap who's designed this? How do I pronounce his surname? When I read it, looks like Jake Evil. But there's an extra L on the end. So what's the correct pronunciation?
I'm going with evil.
But anyway, however you pronounce it, very cool. And it's called the Cortex Cast. So have a look online if you want to see the photos. But it looks very, very cool. And quite a neat project. Initially, I was wondering how on earth you'd get your limb into it, but it's designed that it would fold. It'd be two halves basically, and would join together, so you'd be able to get into it. But the idea is that they do a 3D scan of your of the limb concerned, as well as an X-ray, and then on the computer it puts it together, and then a big 3D printer will fire out this thing. The one challenge I thought that they would probably have at the moment would be around just how strong this cast would be. But I guess that will be improved as we get bigger and better and tougher 3D printing machines, which no doubt will come. Maybe there is already one that could do this well. But that was the one thing from the 3D printers I've seen. I think there'd potentially be a size issue, because a lot of them only print quite small stuff. Just in terms of how robust the output is, could be a challenge. But I can imagine this you know, taking off within the next few years as those boxes get ticked.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, what else have we got going on? Chorus, who are taking care of a reasonably large percentage of the rollout of ultra-fast broadband in New Zealand, have announced their plans this week for the rollout of ultra-fast broadband through to mid-2016, which is kind of nice because there was really we were, I think, only getting the figures through to mid next year, mid 2014, in terms of you know, whether your address would be able to get ultra fast broadband in that time. And you know, if you weren't going to get it in that period, you were always just listed as getting it by 2019, which is when the project's supposed to complete. So, if you are interested in that, you can have a look on Chorus's website. We've also got links on our on the little website we set up around UFB at ufb.org.nz to all the maps from the various providers around the country, and there's a bunch of plan comparisons and so on there as well. But yeah, there is a big list of places that are getting ultra fast broadband by that time. But of course, it is a big project and doesn't finish until sometime in 2019. So yes, I'm sure there'll be a few people disappointed that they didn't turn up on that list.
Me included. Yeah.
I'm just looking now. I'd missed the story, so I didn't know that updated. So I'm July 2015.
Oh, you're getting it.
Very exciting.
Nice. So, yeah.
But too far away though.
Be 2 years ago. Well, my current home is not on the list. But what it is on the list for is something that Telecom have just launched this week, which is VDSL. Now we know VDSL's been available as sort of a premium version of the DSL that most of us have had at home for years. For a couple of years now in various forms, but mostly from only really from the smaller internet providers. So with Telecom jumping on board, that certainly stirs things up a bit, and it's going to be available in lots and lots of areas around the country, including at my house. So I'm quite pleased about that. If you jump on Telecom's website, you'll be able to check whether you can get it. And you can also find that through the Chorus website as well, because it's Chorus that delivers the underlying sort of infrastructure that makes VDSL possible. And it's their recent sort of pricing realignment of VDSL services that's sort of bringing VDSL mainstream. Now, have either of you guys had a play with VDSL at all, other than the VDSL that we're running over here in the studio?
As I torrent on Paul's connection and he gets a cease and desist. No, I haven't. But I suppose it's worth saying that with VDSL, it is distance dependent, isn't it? So if you're too far away from an enabled exchange or an enabled cabinet, it's not worthwhile. You might as well just stay on ADSL.
Yeah, and on the Chorus website, you'll know that you can get VDSL if you're... if they're listing you able to get a 20 megabits or greater service. And yeah, that's right. It's only a portion of New Zealand homes that can get it. One of the nice things is you can potentially get it if you're in a rural area that isn't on the UFB map at all. No guarantees, but as Nate says, depending on where you sit in relation to an actual exchange or to a street side cabinet, and how far that that run is of the cable. In most cases, you've got to be, I think, under a kilometre to really get a really good result. Although technically, it's possible to connect from a bit further out as well. And I guess the big thing is this is somewhat like ultra fast broadband, in that with VDSL you get much improved upload speeds. So quite commonly people will be getting in the direction of 10 megabits upload speeds, which is rather nice.
And at the moment, I think the two there's just Telecom and Snap that are the two that you can get VDSL through at the moment?
Oh, no, there's quite a number of players that that do it.
Are they just the two recent ones that have announced?
Voyager do it. Well, what Snap have done is they've just announced refreshed pricing on the same day as Telecom announced their pricing.
Yep.
Telecom, with most of their their residential offerings, are about $10, or they're up $10 more than their existing ADSL plans. I think there's a $99 install there, but one of the niceties of Telecom's offering is they are providing people with a free modem router, which, of course, you do need that with VDSL. Your old router, ADSL router, is very unlikely to work unless you've got a really, really expensive one that was designed for VDSL, which would be very few people will have actually have. They're making it quite easy, and whereas most of the other providers are saying, "Hey, you do need to buy that new router that has VDSL capability, which can be a few hundred bucks." Kind of good. And Telecom for business customers, they have a 200 gig plan. It's 200. Yeah, I think it's a 200 gigabyte plan. And that actually sits, from what I can see, it sits at the same price point as their existing ADSL 200 gigabyte plan. So making that pretty attractive option for businesses that are in the right area.
Does Telecom allow you, because I was a bit unsure, but I'm assuming this is right, that because it's $10 more expensive than the ADSL, you still, for people who've got naked broadband, because Telecom still don't have a naked
broadband. They don't have a naked broadband offering.
So you need to have...
You have to have a phone line with it. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
So that works. That does work into the pricing. I guess the other point, which is interesting, is that Vodafone have yet to announce either VDSL or UFB services for their customers. They have certainly been trialling ultrafast broadband for some time, because I was on their trial going back a year or so, and they're still sort of hooking people into that. But in terms of a formal offering, they don't have that yet. And there was an article I looked back on when Paul Brislin was with Vodafone back in 2008. So we're talking 5 years ago, where VDSL was effectively announced by Paul at that stage with Vodafone. And here we are 5 years down the track, and they still don't have it. So I'm sort of hoping that any day they will they'll fill out those gaps and start offering VDSL and as well as ultra fast broadband, because it's a bit of a frustration where you don't have the full choice of providers.
Do you know, Earl, if you can get VDSL?
I definitely can't. We checked that earlier today.
Yeah, we just had a look on the map.
What suburb are you based in Auckland?
Dairy Flats. So according to the website at the moment, I have ADSL broadband is unavailable at my address. From Telecom, so VDSL is a little while away from me.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So there are a lot of those sort of situations. Interestingly, it is worth if say the Chorus maps are showing something pretty negative, it is worth sort of checking with Telecom or with whichever telco that you prefer, because sometimes you will get something quite different to what they're publishing. As we found with someone in a rural address in the last few days. So
there's a big thread going on Geekzone about this when Telecom announced it, and a couple of the Telecom employees have actually been very good, and they've said, look, if you type in your address and it comes back you don't have it, please call us on this number and we'll do sort of a manual search and we'll confirm exactly whether you can or can't do it. So
cool.
They've been really engaged in that sort of social which is nice to see from Telecom.
Yeah, it is, because you expect sort of the bigger organisations to be somewhat faceless, and we've actually got another podcast that'll be online shortly, discussion we had with ASB as well, and talking about, I guess, these larger organisations, banks, telcos and so on, are really starting to become much more open than what they were in the old days, as large faceless organisations, thanks to you know, what is able to happen over social media for those organisations that have chosen to, you know, really embrace it. It makes it, you know, much easier to really, you know, connect with the organisations and find out what's going on, which is kind of cool.
I do think you've got to be careful with it. There was a, and I was reading it with great amusement yesterday on Twitter about, so Bank of America have got their Twitter account, and instead of taking the whole social thing over, it's actually another way to engage with your customers. They've decided to be very lazy and they've created a bot on Twitter, well, not hard to do, which replies to particular terms. And so someone was complaining about how the bank's foreclosure policies, and so the bot tweeted out, hey, I work for Bank of America, is there anything I can help with? And then you'd reply, and then it would say, can you send us more information, to the fact where you could say anything completely stupid to Bank of America, and it would tweet back these responses. And I can't find the post at the moment, but there was, people worked out there was 6 generic responses, so it would return to particular terms, or there were the number of replies that you'd done, it would reply with particular things. And it's like, well, you guys have sort of got the idea, but you're sort of missing the execution completely. So
yeah, not good, is it? And I guess that's a challenge when a really big organisation you know, tries to make use of social media. They either need to have a really, really big team, or they've got to be really, really smart about how they, you know, how they utilise it, because they could get a, you know, huge amount of traffic. And I guess in this case, yeah, Bank of America is trying to be really, really smart, but actually it makes them look really, really stupid.
Mm. Yeah, dangerous places. Dangerous places.
So, yeah, social media certainly has some challenges associated with it. But we've seen some really great examples in New Zealand of people really really doing it right, which is good. Talking about Vodafone not having UFB and VDSL, interestingly, in the last, I think it's probably in the last couple of months or so, they've launched a new router for their customers, and the associated documentation with it actually mentions it being quite suitable for ultra fast broadband. So it looks like they're certainly getting geared up for ultra fast broadband. Whether they're getting geared up for VDSL, they have not confirmed to us yet. So yeah. Now I've got Telecom have been kind enough to offer me a little trial of their VDSL service. So I'm hoping that will be in by next week, and I can actually give my real world experience on what that's like to get installed and just how quick it is with their new service. Another little somewhat local story is there's been some new language packs for Microsoft Office 2013, Windows 8 and Internet Explorer 10. Te Reo Māori language packs have become available in the last few days, I guess. Good to see this. But the interesting thing was this was covered by quite a lot of international media. I saw Wall Street Journal picking it up.
Cool. Yeah, no, it looks very good. I'm not a Microsoft Windows user, but it looks fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's just good to see that, you know, the big companies and, you know, Google, you know, had Māori, you know, language sort of support, you know, within their search engine for, you know, for quite some time. I'm not sure if they offer that within any of the Google apps and so on as such. But, we just seem to be seeing, you know, more and more support for a broader range of languages, which is, you know, all credit to software companies for you know, for getting alongside, and I think that, you know, certainly you know, will help in school environments and so on where languages are being taught.
Mm. Interesting, they've got 108 languages, I see, only. So it's quite a few.
Yeah, it is. But I think there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of languages. Around the world. So I mean, it's nice that that we're getting noticed down here in New Zealand anyway.
Absolutely.
Now, Apple celebrating 5 years this week since the launch of their App Store, which, yeah, that sort of swung by pretty quickly, hasn't it? Because when the first iPhone launched, there was no App Store, And if I remember correctly, Steve Jobs was, you know, not particularly keen on there being being an app store. I think Apple wanted to sort of, you know, provide the apps that were on the phone, and you would sort of just get that. But then there were a number of people, including some enterprising Kiwis, who started working on their own apps and worked out how to get them onto phones. And then, of course, you know, Apple did launch the App Store, and to phenomenal success. They're now at over 900,000 apps. That's a pretty crazy number.
It is a crazy number, and, you know, as you know, someone who's got friends who are developing on that platform, you know, I think the success has just been amazing.
So, do developers find it hard to get their apps noticed? Is that a challenge for the app developers that you know well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the biggest challenge now is with the sheer number of apps on there, is making sure you know people know where to find it and get hold of it. So yeah, that seems to be the biggest challenge now. But yeah, Apple have done a great job with that community.
And I guess, you know, we've seen Android sort of following in the footsteps to some degrees now. They're up to certainly a pretty massive app catalog themselves on the Android platform. And I think we heard the other day that Windows 8 is up to, which hasn't even been out a year, is up to over 100,000 apps now as well. So there is a huge amount of growth, but Apple certainly, you know, leading the way there with the number of apps on iOS. And I think overall, yeah, there's on any platform there's going to be some rubbishy apps, but you know, I think iOS is still sort of the platform to beat from an app, you know, an app perspective. They still seem to get most apps first, or the apps, you know, get kept updated. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's far easier to monetize something on the iOS platform than it is on Android. And I think I was just quickly skimming that article. Well, the end of that article, it was saying that Apple far outweighs or far beats Android in relation to actually earning money on.
I guess it's much easier to sort of pirate apps on the Android platform, isn't it?
Yeah, because once you've got, unless you jailbreak your, and I'm not big with iPhones, so I've never had one, but I'm assuming unless you jailbreak it, there's no other way to get any apps on it. Whereas with the Android you just have to tick support unapproved apps, I think it is, and then you just double click an APK file and it's on there.
And away you go. Yeah.
So certainly one of the biggest challenges we've seen at Adobe is, you know, getting content onto these smart devices, whether they're Android or iOS, and certainly with the Windows platform coming out, you know, we've had massive success with people building apps through, you know, some of our software solutions. And one of those, digital publishing suite, you know, I think we've just pushed through 100 million download.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. That number came up very quickly for us, so, you know. Yeah, so there's a big market out there.
Mm. And what about tools like PhoneGap? How important is that? Because that lets you build apps that'll run on multiple platforms, right?
Yeah, probably not my area of expertise, but certainly a popular option. Mm. I do think the big challenge is making sure that you're choosing the right method for your application, right? So In a lot of instances, it might make sense to use PhoneGap build, but certainly, you know, you've got to pick it right. As opposed, you know, there are times when a native app absolutely should be the best way forward.
Yeah, totally agree. The PhoneGap's nice, and you can interface with some of the hardware on the device. But even things like PhoneGap can't emulate the way you develop an app for iOS is going to be different from the way you develop for Android and the way you develop for Windows Phone. The way iOS users are used to even navigation and all those sorts of things is very different from the way Android users and Windows Phone. So I think PhoneGap's a very good starting block. And ASB, for example, their first mobile banking app was pretty much PhoneGap wrapped around a mobile site.
Yep.
They've now seen that, no, we need to, for the different platforms, we need to have native apps for all three. So I think PhoneGap's a good sort of stepping stone to get a presence on the different platforms. But long-term wise, if you're serious about mobile and mobile content and plug into whatever desktop solution or web solution you've got, you need to have native.
Yeah, and people using the apps are very savvy now, right? So they expect the experience to be good. And certainly there's a place for PhoneGap to meet some of those requirements. But yeah, as you say, for an organization like ASB, well, that's a big call. Yep. But, you know, they're underway and they're building native apps now, and it's fantastic. So.
Yeah. Now, on the ASB front, they're hard at work on a business version of their banking app as well, which is I think that'll be the first bank locally that's doing a specific business version of their app, which will be quite handy, actually.
Business banking is a lot trickier, and I know because we've got a few accounts here and there, and it becomes tricky because you move from sort of one person logs in and sees multiple accounts to very role-based. So you can have, for example, an administrative user who can only see and log in and set up payments. And then you can have a director who can log in and approve payments. And then if you've got multiple people to sign, I don't know what it's like for Gorilla, but for example, with 3Bit, we've only got one person, which made it far easier. But if you've got multiple people to sign, then the app has to take that into account. So it's not sort of, let's build an app for residential and one sign-on, and then we'll just build a business one. The business one is completely
different. And what they said to me, and we've got a separate podcast covering this, but one of the things that that stood out is they're really looking for the things that that a business user will want to do, and one of the common ones is just a director, for instance, or a signatory will want to just approve payments. Somebody else has keyed them in, but it'd be really handy if they didn't actually have to get in front of the full website and with their little token and that sort of stuff to authorize. Yep. So that sounds quite cool. Now, jumping back to Apple's 5 years of the App Store, one of the nice things that they're doing to celebrate is they've taken what they're saying are 5 landmark games and 5 groundbreaking apps and making them available free to everyone for a limited time. So their landmark apps are Barefoot World Atlas, Day One Journal and Diary, How to Cook Everything Over, which is an ability to sort of drop custom captions and logos and bits and pieces on top of photos, and Tractor, which is sort of a DJing app, Tractor for iPhone. Those are all available free at this moment in time. The games Badland, Infinity Blade 2, Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP, Tiny Wings, and Where's My Water? So we'll try and flick up some links on probably at nztechpodcast.com or on my Tech Jungle blog to those free apps, or you can just go and search for them. So, that's very nice. Always good to get cool free stuff.
I don't know any of those apps. Shows up out of touch on iOS, and it's like, no, don't know that one.
Well, when there are 900,000 apps, you can probably be forgiven for not knowing 10 of them.
You think I'd know one of them?
Oh, come on.
I suppose I know all the free ones. They're not obviously going to give away a free one when it's already free.
So hopeless. Yeah. But all very nice. So yeah, we do certainly like our free stuff. Talking about banking, Westpac are launching a home loan app, so you'll be able to go, and they've offered this recently, where you can go online and apply for a home loan online, which you expect to be able to start doing that sort of thing now. They're now moving that into an app form, which I think is rather good. I don't know how easy it'll be. I think for it to work, it needs to be really, really easy. And so I hope they've kind of nailed that, and it does actually make the process easier.
I could just imagine, my dad used to be a real estate agent, so I'm very familiar with real estate and auctions. And everything. I could just imagine you standing there bidding, and then you get to like the amount of money that you can spend, and you furiously bring up the app, like, and there's a plus button, you just go, plus, 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 plus. Yeah, I'm back in, I bid again.
Try and bump up, see if you get approval mid-auction.
And the app pops up saying, are you sure you want to do this? You're like, yes, come on, I really want this house. Maybe not so much.
That could be a lot of fun. The banks are sort of in there going, yeah, we'll approve that, but it's an extra this much percent. And as you go higher, they're just like, oh, and we will do this if you want that much money.
It's a big proportion. They're saying 10% of their mortgages are
being applied for online.
Yeah.
Well, you'd expect ultimately it all to go that way. You know,
which is why the company's office, was it last week, renamed, was it Real.me or something, or Real.me, which is the new, instead of iGov, it was a new way to do identification. They're talking about you'll eventually get to the stage where you can have this sort of global ID, which the government's going to control, and then use that for applying for mortgages and finance, anything else that you would, instead of having a signature, you can just use your Real.me identification.
It's much easier for the government then to track exactly what you're doing and to know all about you. And then anyone else who has access to their database, or if they get hacked. It's an exciting world ahead, isn't it? Now, so Earl, what we would love from you is a bit of an update on what is happening in the Adobe world. Now, I guess the big announcement in recent weeks has really been Creative Cloud. And, you know, most people know Adobe for, I guess, there's a few products. There's, you know, Adobe Flash. We've sort of got used to loving and hating, you know, Acrobat or Reader, you know, for many years, a sort of standard, you know, way of you know, sharing documents, you know, very handy file format. I don't know what we would have, where the world would have gone without it. Things would have been looking pretty well, they're pretty ugly without Acrobat, but really, from a business perspective, it's mostly sort of creatives that tend to use the Adobe apps. People doing graphic design, doing video stuff, recording audio like we do. Run us through what's happened to Adobe's Creative Suite, where it's gone, and what this new Creative Cloud thing is all about.
Sure. One of the things I love doing is when I go in to meet with people about Adobe products in general, I'll always start the meeting out with, so what do you know about Adobe? And generally everyone will come back with, you're that annoying browser thing that always wants to update, or you've got that Photoshop thingy that you can retouch models and make them really beautiful for magazines, and you've got that PDF reader thing. And they all sit and go, but they all seem like they're free, so how do you guys actually get anywhere? So, you know, it's interesting, right? So, as you pointed out, the creative market is really the backbone of the company. But PDF, as a standard, has been adopted widely over the last 25 years. And that certainly plays a big part, but they're quite different, right? So we sort of look at Acrobat and that PDF standard as being very much an enterprise-type product. So we've got big adoption across banks, and anyone, like you said, you know, really resolved a big issue around sharing documents elegantly between Macs and PCs, between people who had fonts and didn't have fonts, and how those documents would be shared. So so PDF's been very successful for us, and again, as a standard, probably the standard that everyone shares a lot of documents with, right? So
now you take that off, what's new?
What's new? Well, Creative Cloud is new. So, you know, everyone knows and loves our image products around Photoshop, InDesign, Illustrator. You know, we really believe these are sort of like class-leading products, right? So if you're doing page layout, it's InDesign. If you're doing vector artwork for logos and things like that, it's Illustrator. If you're doing image editing, Photoshop. And we've had big success with our video products. So, yeah, so, and everyone's used to buying our product. As I said, you know, when we started, they were just separate products. And then they said, well, if you check them in a box together and call it a suite, can you make it cheaper?
And I guess that's what Microsoft did with Microsoft Office, right? Once upon a time, there was Microsoft Word and Excel, and eventually it became Office with Outlook and PowerPoint and et cetera.
So yeah, pretty similar, right? So people were like, well, if you can chuck a couple of them together and we'll call it a suite of products, we'd rather buy it that way. It seems like a better idea.
And you guys got to, I guess it's simpler, and you maybe, bump people up to a bit of a higher sale than just selling one product as it was once upon a time.
Yeah. So so that made a lot of sense. But certainly, the last sort of probably the last 3 years really in the design community, a lot's changing really, really quick. So, whether you're a web designer, the web's changed massively in the last few years. If you're a print designer, you're expected to be able to design for all of these new smart devices that have come out. So the iPad's not that old. But print designers are expected to be able to take the content, which would have been for a static print ad, and supply that now so it works on an iPad. So a lot's changed for creatives.
Mm.
And so, you know, Adobe's response to that was really around, you know, we want to be able to innovate and get our tools out quicker in a much smarter way, in a much more efficient way. And that was one of the problems we had with Creative Suites, right? So you had all your separate products going into one box, and that had to meet a deadline, which had to go out to be, you know, pushed out to the market worldwide. And if the Photoshop guys weren't finished, well, their product went out, you know, it might have been missing a few features that would have to wait for the next upgrade, which was sort of an 18-month period, sometimes 2 years. So that was a real problem for us. And so the new product now is Creative Cloud, and it means that you can get access to all of the tools. And we, as our product teams develop new features and new stuff, it can come out and it can be released straight away. So
yeah, so things that there are changes sort of rolling out, I guess, you know, all the time in terms of new features. And I guess what was Creative Suite, the last version of that was CS6. That's now sort of gone by the wayside in terms of, you know, a box product you go out and buy. So it's now
so that'll be the last perpetual product that is available as a suite.
Right.
Yep. So CS6.
And now it's subscription based, basically. You pay a monthly fee, you get access to everything.
Yep.
You get a bit of cloud storage thrown in there as well.
Yep. So we've got different plans for different purposes. You know, we've got individual plans to suit, you know, your freelance designer type person or people that maybe aren't using all of the tools, but then we've also got a Creative Cloud for Teams, which is a real sweet spot for New Zealand market. So, you know, your design studio with maybe five designers in one place, you know, helping them collaborate better on their work, make sure everyone's got the same versions of software and all the kind of challenges that a lot of creatives have here.
Yep.
So we've got an offering for that, which is tailored for their use. So, you know, strong collaboration story there. As they're designing, sharing and working and going home and continuing to work, which is what a lot of them do. And then right up to the enterprise type customers. So, you know, your large enterprise customers, and, you know, we've got a big ad agencies and things like that.
They have lots of users.
So their challenges are a little different, you know. So for those guys, you know, for the small studios, they get 100 gig of online storage available for each user. So, you know, we were talking to a studio of about 40-odd people the other day, and, you know, for them, that's 4 terabytes of storage. So they get relatively interested in that.
Yeah.
And so we're doing some unique things with our storage that, you know, the likes of Dropbox and that probably don't do. But, you know, we're able to share files in a way that nobody else can. So yeah, it's unique things that we're doing, and it's pretty exciting.
And in terms of products, when you sign up, and what sort of the you know, the base price, you know, let's say, you know, for an individual, when I look online, I'm seeing you know, Australian dollar figure of, you know, $50 a month as kind of your you know, your mainstream pricing, I guess, as a way to sort of buy that locally as opposed to online as well. Is that, how does that sort of line up?
Yeah, so the individual one, again, is tailored for that single user. And again, we've got a pretty extensive price list, and it's not the easiest thing to navigate through if you're looking through that.
Never is with these big software companies. We sort of get used to that.
I know. So, you know, we're trying to look after our existing customers who've come along, you know, over the last few years with our Creative Suite products. So there's an offer in there, you know, where they're paying $30 a month for the first year, Australian, as opposed to somebody who's never bought our product or never owned it, you can go in at $50.
Yep.
So we're trying to recognise people that have invested in the product previously. For individuals, you know, there's great offerings there for teachers and students.
Cool. And now Creative Cloud basically gives a user access to like a lot of products now, right? So you've got Photoshop, InDesign, Illustrator. What are the other top four or five
apps?
You've got audio editing stuff as well with the Audition, right?
Yep. So, you know, you got your basic stuff that people know, right? Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, Acrobat's in there, Flash is in there, Premiere Pro, so our video editing
stuff. Cool.
After Effects. And then we've really been able to, with this product set, move into some new areas for us, right? So there's a lot of new products in there that people probably aren't aware of.
And is that for stuff like doing the, you know, publish something to an iPad, for instance, get something onto an iPad?
Yeah, so as part of your membership, you get access to our digital publishing suite of tools. And again, that's being able to take your InDesign content and ship that out as an application to an iPad. So, you know, that's all built into your membership. You know, we've come away, you know, we've had some great feedback from the web community, you know, where we used to have Dreamweaver being the one tool that did everything.
Yeah.
And so what we've been able to do is, you know, went to the community and they said, look, yep, sure, we understand you've got Dreamweaver and it does all this stuff for us, but what we really want now to be, you know, to be able to design and interact with the web quickly and easily is I have a favorite editor. I don't want to use Dreamweaver for that. We want to be able to do HTML5 compliant animations. So what we've got is a whole lot of web services that are very small tools that do one specific job. And that's our Edge tools and services family. And in there we've got one very lightweight tool called Edge Animate, but it makes fantastic HTML5 animations. And that's all it does. So you go in there, animate your banner, export that out as HTML5, right?
Yep,
and you
done.
Can repurpose
now.
It.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So, you know, lots of new stuff in there, and we're adding to that all the time.
Now, with any sort of change like this, I mean, that move from being able to buy a bots product, you pay for it once and you can keep it for, you know, keep using it forever, effectively. Now, always up front to get, like, the, you know, the top version of Creative Suite was, you know, well, it was way over sort of $3,000. And even, you know, even for the basic suites, you know, you're looking sort of a couple of grand or so. So being able to bring that down to say, you know, $60 or so, you know, dollars a month is, I'm sure, attractive to a lot of people. But there are going to be people that are really annoyed that they're not able to sort of buy those updates as they choose anymore, that they've got to, you know, stick in. What sort of, you know, where are you finding that sort of resistance where people just are not into this whole, you know, pay each month type model?
Yeah, look, I think one of the things we wanted to address with Creative Cloud was that cost of ownership, or the initial, you know, getting into our tool set. We always knew it was expensive, right? So so that was always something that we were challenged with. And as you said, you know, our master collection was up over $6,000, right, to get in. So if you were wanting to start in this industry, it was $6,000 for everything. So, you know, we've seen a lot of people are still pretty passionate about buying and owning their software. But we've certainly seen, you know, the uptake of this offering has gone really well for us here. And I think, as you said, it's really hit a good, you know, a good spot for a lot of people who do this for a living. So some of the challenges around people that are probably casual users of our product, and the one that seems to hurt most seems to be Photoshop.
Yeah, so people that just wanted to run Photoshop.
Just want to run Photoshop, yeah. Right. So you can subscribe to Photoshop as a single application, right?
Right. So there is a lower cost option now to get the one app, whereas initially you had to buy it. It was sort of all or nothing, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, okay. For Photoshop, if that's all you wanted, you know, you can subscribe to that for $20 a month Australian.
Right.
Yeah.
So okay.
We're trying to address it.
So it's not all bad.
It's certainly we've certainly had a lot of good feedback.
Yeah. No, I mean, my pick is, I mean, this is going to see more people using Adobe products than they had before. You get rid of that big upfront cost, and especially a lot of small businesses that would be, you know, just reticent to sort of jump in there. And when you can sort of pay a monthly fee, it does make it somewhat more palatable. What do you think, Nate? Would I mean, have you used any of the Adobe
stuff? Yeah, Dream.
Stuff?
I remember in my earlier days, I used to use Dreamweaver all the time, especially when you're doing PHP coding and stuff. But Visual Studio for the stuff we do, because we're predominantly a Microsoft shop, is the do. So when you said Dreamweaver, it was like, oh, I remember Dreamweaver and Fireworks and Photoshop. Yeah. Not that we do a lot of that stuff anymore. I have to admit, one of the biggest pain points for us is that to get into the suite, and I'm not complaining about the quality. Like, you can't say, oh, it's the products were way too expensive, because they weren't. They were very good, and they were top of the line for what you wanted to do and very easy to use. It's expensive. If you're starting out as a new company, as we were sort of 8 or 9 years ago, trying to get all those products in, as well as all the Microsoft products, it's very expensive. So I'm a big fan of this pay sort of as-you-go model. And you know, online product zero, as we mentioned again, is paid bi-monthly, and I think all these cloud services are moving to that, so it's a nice thing that Adobe's doing the same thing. And $20 for an individual user for Photoshop a month is just fantastic.
Australian.
So it's about 1,000 New Zealand, but still, it's pretty good. I don't know what the RFP of Photoshop is, but it's a lot more than $20 a month.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you were talking way over 1,000 to get started, weren't you?
Yeah, I think so.
Direction.
So, you know, you're looking at, you know, in that 1 year that we've had Photoshop available as a subscription, we've had three major releases in that year, whereas between the previous version of CS6 and CS5 Photoshop, there was a 2-year wait. So, you know, our Photoshop community sat out 2 years, and they were getting pretty grumpy with us, going, when are you bringing out the new one? And we're like, well, hang on, maybe the InDesign team need to sort this out and before we can get the new suite out. Yeah. So, you know, it was pretty difficult.
Mm. I'm assuming, too, this is going to make a sizable dent in any piracy of the Adobe products. But you're going to go, well, look, it's $20 a month. What's the point of trying to find a torrent to download this? I might as well just pay $20. It's so cheap.
I'm sure that's what Adobe's thinking. In other news, got an email through from Dick Smith just in the last hour or two. And it seems like they've become good buddies with Vodafone again, because I think we're looking early 2011 that Dick Smith stopped selling Vodafone, you know, handsets and products and so on. But they're they've buddied up again, and they're now offering Vodafone products. So very interesting. Hit them up if you are looking for a new phone or something. Now, there's a couple more topics that that we were hoping to get to around home cinema and getting rid of your Sky, or just, you know, changing your home setup. We're going to save that for next week's episode. There's some changes or some discussion going on around reviewing some of our telecommunications regulations in New Zealand. We're going to hold those off for next week too, because we have Paul Brislin coming in, who is the guru in that area, so he'll be joining us for that discussion. And we'll talk a little bit more probably next week also around Telecom's mobile wallet trial that we chatted about last week. So that brings us just about to the end. Oh, now there was one thing. We had a new handset from Huawei. When was that? It was probably a couple of weeks ago, and we were looking at the new P6, which is the slimmest smartphone on the market worldwide. But what we were disappointed in was the pricing numbers we were seeing out of Europe. But we just saw that they're launching this handset in Australia for $495 US. So that's probably indicative of a $600 to maximum $700 type pricing in New Zealand, which actually makes it pretty competitive, which is what we sort of would have expected from Huawei, because That's where they tend to be pitching themselves. So, we'll have a little bit more of a chat about that one in the weeks ahead. The one that we did have a hand on also, we found, is a preview, is an early build of the software. So we're going to try and get the very latest software on that handset, and we'll give a few more details of that one. But a pretty slick looking phone, actually, if it is something of a iPhone ripoff in some regards. But there we go. That's it. That's us for this week on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Now, of course, you can find us online at nztechpodcast.com, facebook.com/nztechpodcast, and we're on Twitter and Google Plus as well. So we like to be liked in those places, so come and find us. You can subscribe to us through iTunes if you haven't found us there already. Now, where do we find you guys online? Nate, you're on Twitter, as you mentioned before, with that very famous Twitter handle of Nate.
It's a double-edged sword, if I'm honest, because, like, for example, anything big that happens with someone called Nate, for example, Nate Dogg, when his anniversary comes up, I just get ridiculous amount of tweets because people don't know how to use Twitter properly. Anyway.
Sorry, Nate.
I'm just at Nate on Twitter, and I blog on Geekzone as well, so you can find me there. I moderate there as well, so probably the best two places.
Excellent. And Earl, you're on Twitter?
I am. I'm relatively new to the whole Twitter thing, so I'm trying real hard. So, it's a little bit... I'm going to have to change the handle. It's a terrible one to have to explain out, but Kiwi_1_Adobe. So that's me on Twitter.
All right. We'll put a link up to it on the nztechpodcast.com, so people can just sort of click through on it.
Yeah, but adobe.co.nz is where we keep all our info. We've got a great Facebook page up there with all of our events coming up. We've got a roadshow coming into town before the end of the month. And so, yeah, a lot going on.
Cool. So. All right. Oh, that's good. And you can find me online on Twitter at Paul Spain. And also on Google Plus and LinkedIn and all those sorts of places as well, and a Geek Zone blog, which is techjungle.com. So thanks everyone for joining us. We will catch you next week right here on the NZ Tech Podcast. See ya.